If you really talk to neighbors and friends who maybe you see as moderate, you know they're not on the right side of the aisle, so you know that they are probably Dems. If you really talk to those folks and you talk about your commonalities and what you believe in, what you think should be right, you find out there's a lot more common ground than there is division. Even though many of we progressive think there can't possibly be moderate positions that we could support, that may not always be true.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, a union town.
Good morning, and welcome to another working week. This is KPFK's Working Voices, and I'm Joe Ayala, president of NABIT CWA Local 53.
And I'm Kristen Parker with the Montebello Teachers Association.
And in this morning's show, our executive producer, Dan McCrory, brings us a conversation with Progressive Democrats of America National Advisory Board Chair Donna Smith. Steve Zeltzer's labor video presents an interview with University of Minnesota's professor and author August K. Nimtz. And in this week's Working Voices update, we look at the ongoing Kaiser Permanente strikes. All this and more coming up this morning on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. This is Working Voices.
In this morning's show, our Working Voices executive producer, Dan McCrory, has a conversation with Donna Smith, chair of the Progressive Democrats of America, and her take on labor's role in today's Democratic Party.
This is Dan McCrory for Working Voices, talking to Donna Smith. Donna is the National Advisory Board Chair. How long have you been in that position, Donna?
Well, I've been the National Advisory Board Chair for Progressive Democrats of America since I left the executive directorship, which was in about 2019.
And you came from doing what?
Well, I had been with the I worked for National Nurses United and the California Nurses Association for about 5.5 years and had lived in D.C. and worked on healthcare reform policy and the policies that nurses needed done before. It was about 2015 when I applied for and became the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America. I had been with them for many years prior as a volunteer and off and on doing some writing, but never in a bigger position. What I do now is I try and make sure that the people that we are interviewing for endorsement, the values that PDA set out a long time ago, the values for in favor of peace and in favor of economic justice and social justice, and the things that we value are being adhered to by the organization as we go forward. We're now 22 years old. We were formed in 2004 in Roxbury, Massachusetts. And it's very important to me that we continue the tradition of PDA and stay within the boundaries of our original mission, was to make sure that we elected people who were progressive, and we made sure that progressive policies became the law of the land.
I've been in the Democratic Party myself for a number of years. I know that progressives tend to get a lot of derision from moderates, and it seems to go both ways. So what's going to heal that, or should it be?
I think it actually can be healed, Dan. I'm not sure the rift is as deep as people want to believe that it has to be. If you really talk to neighbors and friends who maybe you see as moderate, you know they're not on the right side of the aisle, so you know that they are probably Dems. if you really talk to those folks and you talk about your commonalities and what you believe in, what you think should be right in this country, you find out there's a lot more common ground than there is division. And if we can sometimes reach back to one another and say, what do I not know about this issue that I need to know so that I can understand better what a progressive position is? What do I need to know more about a moderate position? Even though many of we progressives think there can't possibly be moderate positions that we could support, that may not always be true. You know, there may be some positions that you think about and you think, oh, you know, I could bend a little bit on that. But on many things, I think we have to just sit and talk with each other and hash out what is it that's keeping us to support one another. I've heard people say that, you know, you can partner with anybody. You can dance with the devil if you can get the work done on your issue. And then you can argue about all the other things that are going on in the world.
Do you think part of our job as progressives is to push the party further to the left?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if it's just the party or whether it's to push the country forward to make progress. That's what a progressive is. You know, a progressive, it's in the word. It's there. We don't have to redefine it. It doesn't mean that we're communists. You know, I was giggling a little bit this morning after watching some snowplows, and somebody had said, you know, uh-oh, here comes that socialist snowplow. You know, it is kind of that idea that we're all socialists. I would be okay with being called a socialist, but I know a lot of people would not. To me, that word just means I believe in social justice and social equity. That's what it means to me. A lot of people connect that with communism. Not the same thing, but a lot of people make that connection. So I think the reality is, for me, if I can just be cool with letting people think that progressives are a little too far out there, and then sit down and talk with them and say, really, what do you believe about healthcare? Do you think the system's working right now? If you think it is, what do you think is working? And what do you think isn't working? And how could we make progress? And that's really what we need to aim to do. We probably won't get to single payer, what I support, because you can see it in my background. I support Medicare for All and single payer in a big way. We may not get there all in one fell swoop. We may not. But if we can partner with people and move forward towards the day when we will get there, that's a pretty great thing.
How quickly did you make that jump from being a writer?
Oh, I didn't want to make the jump, Dan. I didn't want to make that jump. I really didn't. And it was, I had graduated from college as an older student. My husband and I have 6 children. We have a yours, mine, and ours family. We've been married almost 50 years. But I did not have a college degree, and he was a machinist, and I knew I was going to have to work. And I thought, I am not going to be a waitress the rest of my life. I mean, a lot of waitresses I know, wonderful job, wonderful work, but really hard, and really hard nights, late nights. And I thought, I got to get my education. And I went back to school. I started to study, actually, American history and the American political system, really rang my charms a little bit. And I studied, and a professor of mine heard from Newsweek magazine that they were hiring stringers, campus stringers, for a new production they were doing called On Campus by Newsweek. And I sent in a couple of writing samples, and I got hired by a Newsweek editor named Jeff Copeland here in Denver, Colorado. And so for a couple of years, I did stringing work for Newsweek. It was great. Oh, my God, what great work. And then the one dastardly day that I had, Jeff called me one day when I submitted a story about cheating at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And I said, I was so proud of myself. I wrote that story. And he calls me and he says, that is the worst story I've ever read. I was horrified. I thought, I'd never write again. But, you know, we writers can be very determined about our craft. And I listened and I learned. I became the editor of the student newspaper at Colorado College in Colorado Springs. also the head of Cutler Publications, which was the independent student publishing board. It was important to the college because they didn't want to get sued for anything we students were writing in the newspaper. And then I got what I felt was the job that I had always dreamed of. I got a job working as an editor of a small town newspaper in South Dakota, Spearfish, South Dakota, the name of the paper, the Black Hills Pioneer. I was so, so proud to work for that newspaper. I was the editor of that newspaper, and what a joy and what a pleasure. I got to write about everything from a lady's quilting in the churches in Lead and Deadwood, South Dakota, to writing about powwows, to writing about the Sturgis Rally, but also writing about the Senate Majority Leader, who was Tom Daschle at the time. And fortunately for me, I was determined that that writing should include some honesty and some impartiality, that the paper had never really published much on the Democratic side of the aisle, even though we had the Senate Majority Leader in our state. And it did not make sense to me. So I started reporting, and I would ask him some pretty pointed questions when we did press events and so forth about healthcare and about various things. I loved, loved, loved that job. But the minute that I was considered as a subject in a Michael Moore documentary, which was Sicko, I knew the decision I was making was to never be an independent journalist again. No one would ever see me again as somebody who could write independently, certainly about the healthcare system. And I needed to make that choice. You know, there weren't, Michael Moore had said that there were 25,000 people who wrote stories in before they cut off receiving stories because they couldn't read them all. Their producers just couldn't go through them all. So to think that my husband and I were among the 12 stories that were selected to be filmed for that film seemed like an enormous responsibility. You know, it seemed like, wow, you know, not very many people get this chance, and I better make the best of it. And so I said, all right, I'm leaving the job. I'm going to travel to Cuba with Michael Moore. I'm going to get healthcare there, which I did. And that's how I ran into Tim Carpenter from PDA, as I had testified before the House Judiciary Committee. I'm still the only American citizen who had insurance, always had insurance, who was bankrupted by the healthcare system to testify to Congress. Still the very first person. That happened on July 17th of 2007. And Tim Carpenter was in the audience. Tim was one of the founders of PDA. And sitting next to me, there was an expert on bankruptcy and medical debt. And a woman, a Harvard law professor. And I could hear sniffing while I was testifying. And then I heard her lean over and she said, "That is the strongest congressional testimony I've ever heard." And that woman was Elizabeth Warren. And then in early January of 2008, I wrote a piece called 40 Million and One. And in that piece, that we had been publishing a long time that 40 million people in the United States were without health insurance. And that's how I got hired by the nurses, by the California Nurses and National Nurses United, was that article was read. They hired me to work as their national single-payer Medicare for All organizer. And at the same time, Tim Carpenter talked to me about, hey, why don't you come do a little writing for PDA? He paid me $75 a month at first, which was just awesome. It was fine. That's how I got going.
How can we get single-payer PAPs? Do you think that's going to happen anytime soon?
I think it has to. I don't think there's a question. You know, Dan, I'm sorry, but the system is so broken. I'm sorry for all of us. I wrote a letter to the editor in the Denver Post recently about if you go to the hospital right now, and this doesn't matter whether you're in Colorado, California, wherever you are, you must take an advocate with you. You must. You cannot go to the hospital alone right now. There's too many cost-saving measures going on. There's too many hospitals that don't staff properly. There's too many people making money in our system and not taking care of patients the way they need to. And unless you have an advocate with you, you're at real risk. So yes, I believe single payer will come in part because the brokenness of the system is going deeper and deeper and deeper. More people are getting hurt and more are saying, we can't do this anymore. We can't afford this anymore. And taking away benefits from people and asking for competition among insurance companies. Insurance companies only create lower prices by denying care. That's the only way they save money. They're not going to lower your premium. They're going to deny care or reduce benefits. And I think we're getting closer. I don't know that we're there, but we're getting closer. And I think many states are getting closer to saying we can't bear this any longer. The cost not only of uncompensated care, but of watching our people hurt. It's just not worth it.
So where do you see yourself, as they always say, in job interviews 5 years from now? Are you planning to stick it out until we get a healthcare, single payer?
I sure am. I mean, I see myself sticking it out. I want to be there the day we make it happen. I can't lie about that. I haven't given up this much of my career and my life to fight for this without wanting to be there, without wanting to be standing there. Not, you know, I don't have to be. There's way too many people who've worked on this for any single person to take any kind of credit for it. But I think there's so many of us who deserve that kind of care for one another. And we know it needs to happen, and we don't have to, you know, we don't have to overthrow the entire health industry all at once. You know, we can lower the age of Medicare. We can make everybody up to age 10 be covered. There's so many ways we can make this happen in a way that's not horror stories for people who work for insurance companies. Trust me, AI is going to replace a lot of those jobs. A lot of those jobs are going to get replaced. And the thing that needs to be replaced is the system. We need to make change, and we need to make healthcare decisions based on health needs, not profit needs. And when we get to that point, obviously, we've got to get rid of this Republican administration and all of the people who have decided that they can follow this somehow. This is not what America is all about. So I'm thinking that in 5 years, I'm hoping I already will have celebrated with everybody that we've got healthcare as a human right for us all, that we are fighting together with other countries on this planet on climate change, because that belongs to all of us, and we better get after it. What time is not only a waste, and a lot of people told us it's gone for reverse. We're not going to reverse it. We're not going to reverse it. And I don't think anybody in my age group wants to leave this to our kids and grandkids.
How do we create activists?
Model it. I don't think of a better way to create an activist than to model it, right? I think, you know, just like my kids have watched what I've done sometimes, you know, I know a lot of us who have grown children know they don't always understand why we're still doing it. Why we're still fighting it. Why don't we just retire? Why don't we just say we're done? Well, yeah. First of all, that's not in the picture for my generation. It's not in the picture for me. We didn't fight all those battles for women's rights, for civil rights. We have so far to go. But my generation did not fight all those battles just to watch this happen.
Yeah, the numbers I'm seeing for more of the younger generations seeing the labor movement as a no-brainer really give me hope. And I'm tired of the word boomer being used as an insult.
Yeah, agreed. I so agree with you, Dan. It's so true. Because it shouldn't be an insult. It should be something we own with pride. Yeah. But yeah, we did rock the world when we were young. We did fight back on Vietnam. We did find it disgusting what happened with Watergate. But wow, that doesn't seem to hold a candle anymore to what's going on right now. Did we get busy in our own lives? Yeah, absolutely. A lot of us got busy in our own lives and raising families and doing what we... But I know most of the people in my generation, at least in my corner of the world, are very involved citizens, have been for a long time, no matter what it is they're doing for a career in life, they are involved and they care about what's going on. And the recent issues with our immigrant community have been so torturous for all of us. I mean, really, we're all immigrants. We're all immigrants except the Native Americans. We're all immigrants. And this country is rich because of it. And this is the horror of shootings and killings. And it's not us. This is not the United States. This is not the United States. And I think we will create more activists by continuing to be active, by bringing those young people forward. Replace yourself, train somebody, tell somebody how you did it. You know, don't bore them with your entire life story, but if they don't want to hear it, maybe they do want to hear it. And if they do want to know how you worked in your own field, by all means, but give them the chance to do some things. Give them the chance to run a few meetings, to chair something that you might have chaired. You know, do those things that lift young people up and tell them, it's your turn. It's good. It's your turn. We will be counsel for you, but it's time. It's time for us to turn over the reins. Let ourselves be wise elders. I do think some of us are wise elders if we allow ourselves to be. Michelle and Obama are wonderfully wise people. I agree. I think Michelle Obama is a really amazing woman. I really admire her a lot. But I think there are a lot of us out here who are fairly wise boomers. And I think we have been through enough and seen enough change and enough struggle in our country that we can provide the support and the strength and the lift and, yeah, a little wisdom for some of these young activists.
Well, I heard recently you said that we don't believe in retirement. It's more like rewirement.
It's true, right? Yeah. I know. All I can answer when people say, are you going to retire? I said, this is what I love. This is me. Yeah. This is me, my life.
When I AT&T, I was so happy that at last I could finally do what I wanted to do, which is be on the radio and write books.
There you go. There you go. Now, radio, I think it's such an incredible talent. Oh, my God. I watch people who do it. It's hard to imagine that they can do it. It seems so difficult to me, but God love you. I'm glad you can do it. Now, writing, I can go into my, I don't know about you, but I can go into my own little world and everything falls away.
Yeah.
Everything.
Any words of advice others that might be listening?
Keep plugging. Keep plugging, everybody. Don't stop. Don't stop. You know, if you get tired sometimes, it's okay. I get tired sometimes too. I shared with Dan a couple of days ago, listening to a congressman I trust very much. I had to keep turning off my camera focus because it made me weep to listen to what's going on in our country. It just made me very, very sad. But then I thought, okay, that's enough. Enough of that. There's not time for that. Not enough time. You got work to do. So everybody, we got to hang together. Let's make this work. We can make the United States make work. Let's do it.
Thank you, Donna, for your time.
Thank you.
And your words of wisdom, because there's people out there listening, at least I've been told. So we'll see if it helps any. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Dan.
That was Working Voices executive producer Dan McCrory speaking with Progressive Democrats of America chairperson Donna Smith. For more information on Donna Smith and the Progressive Democrats of America, you can find it at their website at pdamerica.org.
'Cause nowhere is safe in this world of change. It's consensus manufactured through bigotry and rage. So billionaires and fascists can rule without a fight. But their will can be broken if the people unite. But their will can be broken if the people unite.
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
Well, there's no denying that we're entering a year where independent voices like KPFK's 90.7 FM have never been more critical. So we here at Working Voices are asking our union listeners for a little solidarity and support. KPFK was trying to get 500 new sustainers before the end of 2025. And seriously, when do union people ever think it's okay not to stand up for working people? That's what I'm here to ask you to do. Take a moment out to keep Working Voices strong. And if you haven't already, go online to kpfk.org or go to our phone lines at 818-985-5735 and pledge 5, 10, 20 bucks a month. Whatever you can, and become a sustainer. Go online to kpfk.org or go to our phone lines at 818-985-5735 and stand in solidarity with KPFK's Working Voices.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles.
This week, Steve Zeltzer, from his Labor Video YouTube channel, interviews Professor August H. Nims, who teaches at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, about the attacks by ICE, the radicalization of the trade union movement, and the growing support for a general strike.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Workweek. And joining us today is August Nims. He is a professor of political science and African and American studies. He's author with Kyle Edwards of a book, The Communist and Liberal in the Second American Revolution. And he lives in Minneapolis, teaches at the University of Minnesota. So welcome to our show, August.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve.
So, August, why don't you give us an update on the latest developments, the murder, Renee Good, and what's going on in Minneapolis today and tomorrow with the possibility of a general strike there?
Yeah, this is the third week, and the Trump administration ICE regime persists in the raids, the arrest, and the outrages that go along with that. They have no, there's no indication that they're planning to cease this offensive, and so we'll see. And tomorrow's response, we'll see how widespread that is. It's not the best test. We will have the coldest weather we've had here in about 5 or 6 years. So it's caught.
For Minnesota, that's a cold winter.
It is. So yeah, the how many people actually stay home and so on. It's hard to calculate, and how many people are not shopping. And the main thing, it's endorsed by all of the major labor movement. That's very important to bring the labor movement on board with this pushback, because the labor movement brings experience and discipline. And that's one of the things that we need right now, lessons and collective responses to this. And the administration is hoping that people will be intimidated by this and will respond in not the most disciplined kind of way, but the labor movement offers that hope, that promise, and so on. So that's a big deal. We've had some of the demonstrations back in December. We had on December 20th, one of the first major demonstrations was widely endorsed by the labor movement. So this is important.
And this historic development of a call for work stoppage, community labor work stoppage, both the Labor Council of Minneapolis and the State Federation of Labor has been endorsed, supported by unions around who are having rallies, New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles. Minneapolis has a history, and there hasn't been a general strike in the United States since 1946 in Oakland. In 1934, there was a very important general strike, July 1934, the Teamsters. And that strike is probably unknown among most workers, and even Teamsters don't know about that strike.
Sure.
But the relevance of the general strike, why is a general strike a response to this attack?
Let me just say, there was really a general strike back in 2006 or 2007. It was in the spring. Remember when the Congress was contemplating passing a bill, a very restrictive bill on immigrant rights, Anybody who was in the country illegally and so on without papers could be arrested. The Sensenbrenner bill. And we had, remember, think about the mass mobilizations in California and elsewhere around that. And one of the responses was for workers in many of the meatpacking plants where you had a lot of immigrant workers and so on. They stayed home. It was a general strike. And but sometimes we don't appreciate it. But yes, that was in 2007, I think, the spring of 2007. Yeah, so that's but you're right. The 1934, of course, is unprecedented. You had most importantly, you had a communist leadership that was led by a conscious, well-known, not underground, by a communist leadership, members of the Communist League of America, the predecessor to the Socialist Workers Party. And that was extraordinary during that upsurge in the 1930s to have that happen. So that is this tradition. But you're right. A lot of that history is not known. I have to, some of us in the classroom, we do all we can here in Minnesota to teach that history.
And they called in the National Guard. Workers were killed. Two workers were killed in Minneapolis, and there were battles in the streets. And
the
repression against the labor movement, the working class. But they were organized. They had a daily newspaper. They were actually organized to take care of people. They worked with the farmers to bring in food. It was a powerful example of what workers can do.
Exactly.
Collectively.
That's
the farmers and the community.
I agree, man. That's a model, a potential model, and it needs to be taught. And there's more consciousness, I must say. There's more consciousness about it now in the broader public than there was when I moved here in 1971. And there were only a small layer of people. Some of the people, I had the privilege of meeting some of the people who participated, who were involved in the 1934 events. Had a big impact on me. Big impact. I had never seen militant white workers, communists, and so someone like me coming with my background of the Jim Crow South and so on to see this and meet those individuals was a real privilege.
And the rise of fascism in the United States and the insurrection, attempted coup that took place, and now the particularly the attack on Somali Americans, black Somali Americans, targeting them, and now going to Maine to target them as well. What does this portend in the future in this country? I mean, this kind of attack and mobilization of these goons, Gestapo type goons in Minneapolis and around the country.
Yeah, I think it's a probing action on the part of the ruling class. I don't see it as a real frontal serious attack. They're probing, constantly probing, to see what they can get away with. First, these kinds of raids and intimidation of migrant workers and so on, as you know, has a long history. And the purpose of it really is not to get rid of that labor. They want to intimidate, constantly intimidate that labor to make it difficult for them to organize, to resist, to be part of unions and so on. And at this particular stage in the capitalist mode of production, the profit crisis, cheap labor, intimidated labor is crucial for restoring profits. That's the only solution the ruling class has at this moment to solve its crisis. So I see it more as a probing action. We had the largest demonstration, I think, in Minnesota history back on the No Kings March. I've been in marches here since 1972. And we had 100,000 people came out for the No Kings March. It's the largest, as far as I know, in the history of Minnesota. And that speaks volumes about the fact that the working class still has access to the streets, to be in the streets. We'll know when a real fascist movement comes along when we no longer have access to the streets. But right now we do that. We need to take advantage of it and so on. So I see this more as probing. See what they can get away with at this moment. And so the response we need now is a measured, conscious, disciplined response. And that's what I think, that's the potential. That's that's what we can do at this moment.
The role of the Democratic Party, I know the Democrats say they're against these raids, but they have passed legislation in the past that actually allowed for it. They voted for funding for ICE and the militarization of the border. And Obama was known as the
border in chief.
So they have a record actually of agreeing that the problem is one of immigration in this country. Maybe you can talk about the role of the Democrats and also in Minneapolis now.
Yeah, no, you're exactly correct. And again, these kinds of raids, these ICE attacks and so on, intimidating immigrant workers is exactly for that purpose, to frighten them, to make it risky for them to be involved in fight backs and standing up and resisting against the attacks of the bosses. I don't think it's really about to get rid of cheap labor. They need the cheap labor. And one of the reasons the United States has been doing reasonably well economically than other major capitalist countries is exactly because of a migrant labor. But the overall crisis, though, the overall crisis of capitalism, and the complicity, you're exactly right, the complicity of the Democrats in this, as long as our class, Steve, as you know this as better as I do, as long as our class does not have its own political party, that's the major challenge for us. As long as our class does not have its own political party, the working class there finds itself in this vulnerable situation. This is the price. Trump's second election is the price the working class pays for not having its own political party. And so the Democrats set up, posed, and try to pretend like they are friends of labor. And Minnesota is fascinating in that regard. As you know, the fusion, the co-optation of the labor. Minnesota had the only labor party, real labor party in this country. Captured state office three or four times in a row. And the Democrats saw that and they co-opted the former Labor Party in 1944 and the fusion that took place. And it's exactly because of the radical revolutionary character of the labor movement here is why that co-optation took place. And the Democratic Party, the working class, the labor movement has been residing within the Democratic Party in a very lame fashion and so on for quite some time. And so many workers, we all, working class, we learn only through trial and error. As Marx and Engels used to say, a drowning person will grab hold to a twig with the hope that it will save them. And so right now, many workers think that what Trump has to offer is a solution, scapegoating of fellow workers and so on. But we know that's no solution.
And in the purges that took place, the Trotskyists who led that strike in Minneapolis were purged out. There was an anti-communist witch hunt, and they were jailed under the Smith Act. The companies, the union bureaucracy, the leadership of the Teamsters, and the government worked together to get them out of the leadership of that union.
Exactly.
And also in the CIO, following the formation of the CIO, there was an anti-communist witch hunt against militants in the UAW and many, many unions to purge the unions, to put in place a corporate pro-capitalist, pro-imperialist trade union bureaucracy, which continues today, supporting U.S. imperialism, supporting the war budget, and supporting labor management, business unionism. However, don't you think that that's going to be undermined now because they can't offer workers anything as far as concessions, which they were able to offer in the post-war period? Cars, homes, America was growing as a result of winning the Second World War.
Right. No, the end of the dream. You can't understand the Trump phenomenon without understanding the end of the so-called American dream for millions and millions of workers and so on. Again, looking for something. They tried the Democrats. That didn't work. You try this. Again, a drowning person will grab hold to a twig in the hope that it will actually save them. And so as long as our class does not have its own political party, this is what we do. It's not unique to this country either.
And there is a split in the capitalist class. It seems that this crisis, social and economic crisis, is forcing these issues to come to the fore now.
It's always important to keep our eyes to think internationally. And to the north of us in Canada, I think the working class is really, really much more advanced on this question, because you've got a so-called Labor Party in Canada and so on, but provincial governments and the federal government is able to break strikes. They're able to use the laws to break these strikes. And so there's an increasing awareness in Canada that there is a need for a general strike. That's being called by serious forces within the labor movement. We haven't gotten yet to that stage that is within the labor movement itself. But that's on the agenda. That's in the future.
What do you think the cause of this crisis in as far as global capitalism is?
I think I've been on a bit of a campaign in the last few weeks, actually since spring, to remind people, or at least not remind, at least to tell people that the world increasingly looks like the lead up to the First World War. The fight over markets, the fight over resources, dividing up the world into spheres of influence and so on. That was the world. That's what Lenin's imperialism was about. We should all go back and read Lenin's imperialism. This is what the world looks like now. And the great thing about Trump, in my opinion, is that he's so naked. He's so naked about what he's doing. And the fact that the most authentic capitalist who's ever been in the White House is leading the charge offers us great lesson, the clarity about capitalism. This is exactly capitalist greed. No, we should welcome this as an educational opportunity to go back and read Lenin.
And of course, you also have AI and the threat of AI to the working class, the fact that millions of workers, Goldman Sachs, 350 million workers could lose their job, and the fact that Trump has put these techno-fascists like Thiel and Musk in charge of the government operations, much like Hitler put in capitalists directly in charge of the German state. There's some who doubt that we have a fascist state. What's your view of the nature of the state and capitalist apparatus today in the United States?
Yeah, as long as we have political space, people like me would not be able to teach what I do in the classroom if fascism was in power. Believe me, I'm old enough. I remember McCarthyism. People like me would not have been able to teach in the classroom. In California, remember in the 50s, you had to sign loyalty oaths to be able to teach. No, we're not at that state. They're not ready to let the dogs out. That will come. They're probing. They're seeing what they can get away with. And that's why we have to resist and stand up. No. We'll know. When, again, what happened here on No King's Day, the fact that we were able to claim the streets and so on, the fact that none of them came, this little action, this right-wing action that took place last weekend, one of the incipient fascist types, what's his name, Lang, this anti-Muslim pro-ICE action and so on. Yeah, we could barely get maybe, a dozen people to come out. The problem is on our side, that in turn progressives are shutting down. You don't want to cut take away the free speech rights. Even folks that we hate and detest and disagree with, and so this will come back to haunt us. This is what history has shown. Every time we take away the free speech rights of our opponents and so on, this will come back and haunt the working class. We need the space. We have the space now. We have the space in a way that, believe me, I can tell you, I grew up in the 50s. I grew up in a semi-fascist regime. That is Jim Crow Louisiana, McCarthyism, and so on. No. We have lots of space.
We still do. Yet the
yes.
Yet the Musk and these people, they have a lot of money, and they will hire gangs. They will hire fascists, and the expansion of the ICE forces is to be used to terrorize people. And so that's a warning about their danger. The other thing is the whole economic crisis. The United States is being demolished by Trump. He's actually disassembling the United States, getting rid of research, getting rid of meteorologists, education. They're basically destroying the United States. And now countries are united against the United States. That's what they're doing. And I think, unlike Hitler, he's not organizing, and he's not giving anything to people. I mean, it seems that there's he's not offering the working class anything other than attacks. So the ability of Trump to mobilize is going to be more difficult if people are angry at him, as they are throughout the country. I mean, he's uniting a lot of people, as he is around the world, against U.S. imperialism.
Right. And again, it's not other countries. It's other ruling classes. It's other ruling class who are organizing, realizing they can no longer have any faith in Washington. This whole so-called balance of power arrangement with NATO after the Second World War, all of that's falling apart. And we're going back to what it looked like in the lead up to the First World War. And the danger, the greatest danger we face, is that this is an age, a nuclear age. This is a nuclear age. 20 million people died in the First World War. Second World War was a continuation of the First World War. 75 to 100 million of our fellow toilers lost their lives. I have no doubt that if nuclear weapons had been available in the First World War, they would have been used by the capitalist powers. So yeah, it's a very dangerous. I don't want to belittle what we're facing and so on. I'm just trying to make the case. We have opportunities to mobilize and to resist and so on, and to use the space we have intelligently and in a disciplined fashion. That's the biggest challenge that we face.
And the working class, of course, has not been defeated.
Of course.
You still have the unions.
Of course.
Those unions are not preparing politically. And I think that Trump would like the pretext of a war to bring in the Insurrection Act, to bring in martial law nationally. And as we know, Nazis do these kinds of things. They create incidents,
right,
that they could use.
And that's why we have to avoid falling into them. That's what I'm saying, a disciplined response.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking with August Nimst. He's professor of political science and African-American studies in University of Minneapolis, an author and writer, and in the middle of this struggle in the working class and against the racism, against the attacks and the ICE raids in Minneapolis. So thanks for joining us.
Steve, it's been a real privilege in talking. It's been fun.
Okay, great.
All right, well.
That was Steve Zeltzer. For more videos and insights from Steve Zeltzer, you can go to his Labor Video YouTube channel, or now you can find him at the Production of Labor Video Project on the web at labormedia.net. For more from Professor August H. Nimst, who is also the author of The Ballot, The Streets or Both, and The Communist and Liberal in the Second American Revolution, you can find that book on Amazon.
We never get paid what our labor is worth. That's why we often in the days on the way to our work. And when we get there, we can't wait to be out. So let me tell you what it's about.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
I'm Working Voices Associate Producer Hal Lohr, and in breaking news, locals of the United Food and Commercial Workers of Southern California, representing Kaiser Permanente Pharmacy and laboratory employees, have delivered a 10-day unfair labor practices strike notice to Kaiser Permanente executives. For a ULP strike being set to begin on Monday, February 9th, at Kaiser facilities throughout Los Angeles, Orange, San Diego, San Bernardino, Riverside, Ventura, and Kern counties. The protest will highlight Kaiser's labor violations throughout negotiations that have prevented frontline healthcare workers from getting what the union calls the fair contract they deserve. Picketing will take place at select Kaiser medical centers throughout the region. UFCW Kaiser employees will launch their ULP strike to raise their concerns at the same time as 31,000 nurses and healthcare professionals with UNAC, UHCP, who are out on their own ULP strike, which started last Monday, January 26th. Negotiations have been stalled for more than a month after Kaiser management walked away from the bargaining table. In December, UFC W770 and other unions with the Alliance of Healthcare Unions filed unfair labor practices charges with the National Labor Relations Board, with allegations stating Kaiser unlawfully refused to bargain in an attempt to bypass the agreed-upon national bargaining process and interfere with good-faith negotiations that had been ongoing since April 2025, pointing out the need for Kaiser to stop delaying, stop focusing on union-busting tactics, and get back to negotiating a fair contract. UFC W770 previously issued a 10-day ULP strike notice on January 26th for selected pharmacy employees that was set to begin on February 3rd, 2026. They later retracted that 10-day notice in order to align with a larger wave of thousands of UFCW Kaiser employees who will be starting their ULP strike on February 9th, 2026. And for more on this story, we go to Reggie Wong, who spoke with union reps for their take on the strike at an ongoing strike at Kaiser Harbor City.
Hi, this is Reggie Wong with a Working Voices update. I'm here at the Harbor City Kaiser Permanente, and I'm with
Shauna Agay Lightfoot.
And Shauna, are you part of a union?
Yes, I'm Shauna Agay Lightfoot from UNAC UHC. I'm a registered nurse here at Kaiser South Bay.
And sir?
And I'm Javier Rodriguez. I'm the vice president locally for UNAC UHCP, which is the United Nurses Association of California, United Healthcare Professionals. And I am also a registered nurse for adult primary care here at Kaiser Permanente.
Tell our listeners, why are you out here?
We're out here. We're fighting for the rights of our patients. We're fighting for the rights of our members. We've been at the bargaining table for over 10 months, and Kaiser is just not seeing the priority when it comes to patient safety, patient rights, and doing the right thing for our members.
What kind of things are going on in regards to patient safety?
We're talking about delay in care. We're talking about nurse burnout. We're talking about nursing staffing ratios not being adhered to, even though we have contractual language in regards to that. We are talking about delays to see your doctor. You're waiting 2-3 months to see your primary care physician. All of these delays and things like that that impact our members.
Can you tell me what has happened during the 7 months of negotiations?
Stalling. So we've been put forth different proposals, and we've had proposals go unanswered from April until recently as October, November, before they initially started having small conversations in regards to it. And most of that is surrounding the patient care, the patient ratios, and the things that we're fighting for in the media, in their press release. Kaiser wants to talk about, though, they're only about wanting money, and it's not only about the money. And we've tried, and we've been very persistent with that, with the organization, to let them know, let's discuss about the patient ratios and what it is that we need to do to fix the issue at hand, get in enough people hired and adhere to the contract that you guys have already committed to and you break very frequently. I'm one of the people at the bargaining table, and they said that they were ready, and they had us waiting approximately 12 hours. They were absolutely not ready to bargain. No managers actually came to this table that we were sitting at, and they put a press release saying we're ready to bargain, and that's not what we're experiencing. 40 bargaining members sitting at the table, ready to do what we can do to avoid the strike, ready to do what we need to do to be there for our patients, to make sure that we did not have any type of interruption. And the this employer, obviously, they were not interested in doing that for our members. They were just interested in the optics of looking as to say, hey, we went to bargain. Well, you can't bargain if you don't send any managers to actually come and sit at the bargaining table.
Javier, what are your observations about the bargaining?
And so, as Shauna has illustrated once again, they called to tell us, be ready at the table, meet us there, and they did not show up. To me, it's a slap in the face. It's ridicule. It's telling the media and telling the news people that, yes, that they're ready to bargain, when in fact they don't even show up. We make a professional calling, nursing does, and you and AccuACP, to Kaiser Permanente to come to the table so we can resolve this, so our members are not interrupted. Part of our family here at UNACUACP includes the pharmacists. Pharmacists have walked out of all Kaiser Permanente hospitals. That means that there is delay in being able to get your medications for our patients that need it, some that could be life-supporting, right, that they must get. We know that a lot of the wait times are hours now for patients to get. These are also patients in our community that don't necessarily work for Kaiser, but pay family of four $1,600 a month for this type of care, to not be able to get in, to not be able to go to the pharmacy, to know that the ER is saturated because the ER nurses have walked out. We really need them to come to the table and settle this once and for all.
It seems like our current presidential administration is doing some things, you know, making some decisions regarding healthcare.
So we certainly know that the current administration in this country is not pro-union, and that they certainly have a lot of the Republican Party now taking the NLRB, which is the board that governs unions and so forth. I have to tell you that it's demoralizing to see that we do have this currently, and that it feels like it's a trickle effect, because Kaiser Permanente has never bargained this way. This is the first time in 55 years at UNACUACP that they've bargained with UNACUACP, and they've lost the vision. The vision of this company was to work for with unions and to provide care for union people, for labor.
Yeah, it just seems like it's all about big business, and you know, we're not Target, we're not Walmart, it's not a grocery store that you're walking into. We're talking about the lives of people, health care. People are coming in for a reason, and it just seems that this company has really truly lost this.
And how can we support?
Well, the community can certainly reach out to Kaiser Permanente. If they see us walking around the building, or honk your horn, remain united with us, with the people that provide the labor, that bring the care to our patients, to know that we are doing this for their safety, and to be able to pay for our kids, our husbands, our wives, our families, to be able to afford our mortgages in California. Knowing that this organization is a viable organization, it is over $70 billion in reserves, multi-million dollars a month in interest alone. We want to make sure that Kaiser succeeds, because we want to succeed, but this has now become corporate greed, and we're asking for them to do the right thing.
Everything that he just said, I mean, if you see us out there, reach out to Kaiser, pick up a sign. If you have 5 minutes, join us on the line for 5 minutes. You know, we're looking for any type of solidarity that we can find, because we're doing this all for you guys. You guys see us, come out, stand for 5 minutes. We would love it.
And so this is Reggie Wong with his Working Voices update, and I am signing off with
Shauna Gay Lightfoot.
Javier Rodriguez, Vice President for UNACUACP at the South Bay Local Affiliate.
And that's our show for this week. We're asking our labor partners, locals, and regional officers to seriously consider underwriting the show, because Working Voices and KPFK could really use your support. So please contact the station at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org to explore the possibilities. We need to hear from you. Email your comments or questions to workingvoices@aol.com. Once again, this is Joe Ayala. Our thanks to Steve Zeltzer, Dan McCrory, Gary Scott, Hal Lohr, Kristen Parker, Reggie Wong, and our guests. Please continue to give what you can to keep us going. We're in this together. And of course, always remember to
educate, agitate, and organize.
Have a great week, everybody.
So much work today, yeah.
KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.